Chiefs in the AFC Championship.
The following program is sponsored. The opinions and statements made by the hosts and guests do not necessarily reflect the views of WBOB or its parent company, the Chesapeake Portsmouth Broadcasting Corporation.
Joining us now, Steve Bannon. He's now the chairman of Citizens for the American Republic, and that is a C4 organization where he's also promoting the America First agenda. Steve Bannon, welcome.
Thanks, John. Listen, I think it's interesting you read it every Monday, because one of the things that inspires me about guys like you is your journey from 2008. I don't know if all of your listeners, but I'm certainly sure that most people in America don't know the hit you personally took in the rebound, that now you're a major radio host, one of the great voices of the MAGA agenda in this country, and you were, like millions of other citizens, quietly took a devastating hit on 2008 and worked your way back from it. But it was individual effort, unlike the elites who bailed themselves out with with $4 trillion, over $4.5 trillion of the Federal Reserve's money.
During the 2008 crisis, most of my listeners don't know this, my wife, Ann, has been with me a very long time. We had two kids in college, and my youngest son at the time, he's 14 now, so you got to go back 10 years, right? So, or 11, so he was 4 or 5. We lost, during that period of time, everything we had, all of our savings, all of our money, my job, my company. We lost our home. Our cars got repossessed. We had no credit, and we were homeless for 2 years, living in an extended stay motel, paying week to week, where I got day jobs in order to pay the rent on a daily, to pay the fee of the hotel on a daily basis. The food that we ate was at the salad bar they had, and that's how we survived. And my son was just going to kindergarten at the time. And so we survived that. And having gone through that, it really changes, Steve, your perspective on life. That's why I read that article every Monday before I get ready for my week, because it's like, okay, I get up at 3:30 every day. Why do I do this? This is the reason, to help other people and to spread the word, because what went down there and the way you lay it out, the profile and courage by President Bush at the time, the $1 trillion bailout, all this money these people got, I mean, it's incredible. And so we were the forgotten middle class that basically got kicked to the curb. And until the president came along and said, hey, that was wrong, I'm going to put policies in place that are much different than that. So thanks for mentioning that, Steve.
Yeah, no, it's one of the reasons that, the Trump agenda is, I think, so important to working class and middle class people. One of the reasons I fight for it in this new C4, I just gave a speech last night in Philadelphia, is I've kind of dedicated my life to this populist movement from the 2008, the crash, because it essentially wiped out the working class and the middle class, as Lark said. We've really never recovered from it. That what we have today, I've said, is almost like neo-feudalism, where you have a top crust of very wealthy, and then you have a kind of an underclass, and then you have this kind of working class and middle class in the middle that really don't have an opportunity to really get ownership in this in the American system. Right, and it's neo-feudalism. It continues to keep you on the wheel of death. There's an article today, actually, that everybody should read. I'll get it to you, John. You put it on your site, on Zero Hedge, that talks about the world right now. The world right now has $244 trillion in debt. We look at government debt, their contingent liabilities, corporate debt, which is swimming in debt. And what has happened since 2008 is that these central banks and these central governments have essentially bailed themselves out, right, and bailed out their donors and the elites. And we're going to, I think we're heading towards another financial crisis in the next couple of years that are going to, it's going to dwarf 2008. And that's why we're fighting for these issues here in the United States, to make sure that the working class and the middle class can survive that and hopefully at some point really start to thrive and get ownership in this amazing economy.
Well, that's what the America First policies of the president is trying to do. And people don't realize, Steve, that have never been in the situation, when things go down and your credit goes bad, like things start to get repossessed, you get foreclosed on, like that happened to us. People don't realize when you have no credit, you can't rent an apartment. I mean, you can't do anything. I mean, you're basically handcuffed. So it was a very, very trying time for people.
But that's, I think, your story, and hopefully you get it out. You go from a middle class existence, which you own a company, you have a stake in society, you have a home. I mean, you're the classic good householder, which is what the the Judeo-Christian West has been based upon for, what, 5,000 years is that kind of good family unit that husbands their resources, and then all of a sudden it's gone. They can go in a flash. And then if you don't really have survival skills and tenacity to kind of, you know, pick yourself up and that grit to get through it every day, it can become devastating. And I think that's a it's a huge lesson for people to understand.
Certainly is a humbling experience. Steve Bannon, let's get to Brexit. In a stunning defeat yesterday, Theresa May's government and her Brexit negotiation goes down in flames. The second, I think, was the biggest defeat ever for something of that size in the history of the United Kingdom. I think you got to go back to 1924 when Parliament rejected that Prime Minister at the time's plan for Irish independence. This is a stunning defeat. What happens to Brexit now, Steve Bannon?
Well, listen, for the listeners, remember, Brexit and 2016 are inextricably linked, right? No one thought that the British were going to exit the EU. That was all done. It was almost classic what happened in the Trump movement. It was really Labour voters. It was working-class men and women in Midlands England that really tipped the scales and joined Conservative and Nigel Farage's UKIP and others to really vote to exit. So, but the Brexit and the Trump agenda are similar in the fact that the elites – and in England, it's been what's called the City of London, which is their Wall Street. The City of London and the corporatists and the globalists there have fought this from day one, just like they fought Trump. So I call it the nullification project. What they've done is fought this thing from day one, hoping it goes away. And so the negotiations with May, Prime Minister May, came over and talked to President Trump very early in the administration. I thought he gave her some great advice. She didn't really heed it, but some great advice. And you've seen this fighting from, you know, the European Union and also really from the United Kingdom's corporatists, globalists, and also the Wall Street of Europe, which is the City of London. And what they've done is it presented a deal that just didn't kind of execute on what the people said. I've happened to think, and I've said this for a while, that you're going to have a no-deal Brexit on, I think it's March 29th to 30th. At around midnight, I think they leave the EU with a hard out, no deal. And I think, and I've had some hedge fund guys actually look at this. A lot of this fear they've been putting in this thing called Project Fear, first off on Brexit itself, and now on the actual implementation of leaving. It's really Y2K. If you remember, at the turn of the century, had this huge thing that on New Year's Eve of the turn of the millennia, that everything was going to stop, that computers hadn't been programmed, et cetera, and it turned out to be pretty much a nothing burger. I think you're going to see a hard exit unless somebody gets in there and tries to have a delay. But I think today the British, over the next couple of days, they'll have a vote. I don't think they'll have a no-confidence vote. Otherwise, it would turn into a general election. And people don't realize Jeremy Corbyn, if they go to a general election, I think Jeremy Corbyn could be the next prime minister of England in the next 8 or 10 weeks. And I got to tell you, the anti-Semites around Corbyn and the dangerous people around Corbyn, not just kind of the Marxist socialists, but really people that I think reject the Judeo-Christian West and its values, will be quite stunning. So I don't think May's government will actually fall, although I think that she may get removed as prime minister. But I think all the forces of the Northern Irish Party, even parts of the Scottish National Party, the Tories, others will bind together to make sure there's not a general election. But it's a I think what you're heading towards is this nullification project, like they try to stop Trump. And you're going to see, I think, the forces of leaving the EU are going to be strong enough to just say, we don't want to delay this, because now people say, let's delay it a year. That just gives the forces of the nullification stronger. So I think there's going to be a big push to leave this March and to leave with no deal and let the British figure it out after they leave.
We're with Stephen K. Bannon, the former chairman of the Trump for President campaign, former senior advisor to President Trump in the Trump administration. He's now the chairman of the C4 organization called Citizens for the American Republic. And you can also see his film, Trump at War, by going to TrumpAtWar.com, TrumpAtWar.com. So, Steve Bannon, what you're saying basically is that the hard cliff, or I think they call it the hard fall, the hard cliff exit of Brexit without this big compromise deal in place, what you're saying is it's really not going to be as bad for the UK as everybody's saying it is.
There's going to be some perturbations, don't get me wrong, but it's not what they've presented it. It's the end of the world. If you leave without a deal, it's the end of the world. It's the typical hype of the globalists, the corporatists, the financial elites of the City of London, to put, you know, the McKinsey's, the Booz Allen's, these multinational corporations, all the party at Davos, commented BBC, The Guardian, the Times of London, the Financial Times, the Economist, every day they're pounding that the world ends for working class people and for the middle class if they leave the EU, right? In fact, today, this Donald Tusk, who's the, I think, the president of the European Commission, one of the most arrogant guys in the world, he essentially said, hey, you know what's going to happen here after that vote yesterday? Britain should just stay in, right? They should extend it for a year and they should just stay in. So this is what the EU, the party of Davos, has been outraged that British subjects actually declared for their independence, declared for their own freedom. Go back to June of 2016, the shock that came to the system, and really Nigel Farage, who had become kind of a cult figure here in the United States, the morning after that victory, the sense of freedom and the sense that the British people had stood up for themselves and taking their country back from the EU. Remember, what the EU has been trying to do is turn these individual nation states to take away their sovereignty and to really run them as administrative units. Okay, and that's what you've seen, this sovereignty movement in names like Orban in Hungary and Salvini in Italy, Marine Le Pen in France. You're starting to see these names come up of people that are sitting there going to their citizens, winning elections by massive numbers and saying, we are populists, we are nationalists, we're part of the sovereignty. What we want is we want our own individual nation state. We want our own culture, our own civilization. Yes, we want to be something, a part of something bigger, but we just don't want to be an administrative unit of some central apparatus like the EU. It's very similar to all the power in the United States at the federal level being sucked in by Washington, D.C. These people rejected it, and of course it's not going to happen. And it's a lesson here in the United States, particularly about the Trump agenda and what you're seeing now, John, about the wall. Remember, the establishment, the elites in this country have no no idea, and they don't intend to flip the keys to the Trump movement just because you won an election, right? You're going to have to win multiple elections, right? And you're going to have to really put your shoulder to the wheel and grind this out if you want to take control of your country back. And it's just I'm not whining about it. It's just reality, you see. So Brexit is very similar and very parallel to the Trump situation. To me, it's quite ironic, John, that here we are in January of 2019, about 2 years from when President Trump took power in January of 2017. We're about two years into it. And you see that every day has got to be a fight. Every day has got to be a battle. And the same thing's happening at Brexit with these working class people in England as happening with working class people here in the United States of America.
When you were a senior advisor to the president back in early 2017, the number one agenda item he had was building a wall, stemming illegal flow of immigrants, and controlling the southern border of the United States. Why didn't the president lead with that initiative? Why did they lead with replace Obamacare when they didn't even have a plan for that? And Paul Ryan had lied to his donors forever. Why didn't you guys say, you know what, we're just not going to do this. First thing we're going to do is the number one promise we made. Why?
Well, look, if you go back to that time, you know, we won in a coalition with the establishment. We came together in August of 16 when we were so far down, put together a coalition. After we won, right, the Republican Party and many conservatives in the Republican Party, they had passed 50 bills replacing Obamacare. And so there was a sense, and Paul Ryan was going to take the lead on this with Dr. Tom Price. They had a plan to repeal and replace Obamacare. We had a tax plan, Paul Ryan's border adjustable tax. Remember the time? A tax plan the Republicans had worked on, the Ways and Means guys had worked on for 7 years, just like they had worked on Obamacare for 7 years, right? This was the central beating heart of kind of the Republican legislative agenda, was the repeal and replace of Obamacare and this border adjustable tax of Paul Ryan, who had dedicated his life to this. This is what he's doing. We were going to take infrastructure, the wall, and others, but we're going to sequence these things in. And what you found out is basically the Republican Party was not prepared really to govern as from a legislative side. And that was the big reveal, I think, of 2017 as you tried to implement this agenda. By the way, President Trump pivoted with Mnuchin and others in the White House. We really worked it and came up with a massive rewriting of the tax code.
Right.
It took just about all 2017. The point you had the most leverage was really in September of 2017. The federal government, as people know, the budget runs out on September 30th. Mm-hmm. You have to have an appropriations bill October 1st to really get more cash. At that time, you had the convergence of that, an appropriations bill, the end of the fiscal year. But the most important thing we had was the raising of the debt ceiling. And Steve Mnuchin until we were out of cash in a, after a couple of weeks in October. That was the natural barrier to force a wall deal. What you found out is that the Republican establishment didn't have the shoulder to the wheel with President Trump. And I think, unfortunately, a number of these CRs got kicked down to March when President Trump signed that one, I think, in February 2018 and promised he'd never sign another one.
Right.
Then he got tapped along. I think the situation we're in right now is very clear. The president has tried for 2 years working with the Republican establishment and the Democrats in the House and the Senate, because you've got to get 60 votes in the Senate to move forward. And he's worked through this appropriations process. It's very evident to me that you're not going to get a penny from the appropriations process. They've deemed that it's immoral. And, you know, what the Trump supporters say, it's central to our sovereignty and our national security. Okay. And the Democratic left and parts of the Republican establishment say it's immoral. Mm-hmm. So that to me, that's unbridgeable. It's not negotiable. To me, it's very evident you have to declare a national security emergency on the southern border and just get on with it. The president's tried every other avenue, including big deals for DACA and amnesty, which I think are ridiculous and never should trade off amnesty for a wall.
Mm-hmm.
And these other deals, they're not going to happen. I think the president's got a clear path forward.
So you believe that he should just reopen the government. Everybody's going to say he caved, but what you're saying is do that, and the next day declare a national emergency, start the military constructing the wall, and let the chips legally fall where they may. Is that my understanding?
No, I think it's sequenced differently. I would declare and notify the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. I would notify the combatant commander with his NORTHCOM, the House and Senate Armed Services Committee, the Secretary of Defense, that here's my analysis of this national security emergency on the southern border. I would notify people. I would get the apparatus in motion. Right. And on this, it's not like before the campaign where you sent troops down to the border and essentially they were washing the trucks mm-hmm. for the Border Patrol. Here's where you're really going to send the military to the border.
Mm-hmm.
The Border Patrol, I think, will back off. They will augment and be in an auxiliary position. You will send the military to those ports of entry from Imperial Beach, California to Beeville, Texas, all mm-hmm. along that 2,000-mile stretch. You will actually take that over with Customs and Border. You will essentially militarize the southern border of the United States. And in that, you will direct the Army Corps of Engineers to begin and commence finally building a southern barrier to protect this, to protect the country and its citizens, and actually to help protect this tragedy of people coming up from through these cartels, these human traffickers from Central America. I think you commence that. Then I think you open the government. I think you say, hey, look, we're going in a different direction. That's going to be court challenges. It's going to be court challenges. But people should remember, you know, the power of the executive in our system, as the founders set it up, has in national security emergencies, has some pretty strong powers. President Lincoln, and I don't need to tell people in the Commonwealth of Virginia this, as you know, I'm from Richmond. The President Lincoln essentially fought the Civil War with executive orders. He waived habeas corpus. He took away the First Amendment to many of the media in the North. He essentially freed the slaves with the Emancipation Proclamation through executive order. The powers, I think President Lincoln's on the record. I don't think it's apocryphal. I think he said one time the Constitution is not a suicide pact, right? So it's the powers of the chief executive in a time of national security emergency. People should understand this whole economic war with China that we're finally engaged in, that the Chinese have run on the American people for 20 years. The whole situation of how we're now winning this with this these tariff wars and these trade deals where the Chinese are now coming begging us for a deal, begging us to give us a great deal, that all comes because President Trump exerted his rightful powers as chief executive officer in the summer of 2017 to get this thing going with the 301s and technology, the steel and aluminum. All of that was done with the same powers the president has on this wall. And so I think it'll be court challenge, but I think it's a challenge the president should welcome. And I'm a strong advocate that he should consider this, because I think he's played ball with the establishment and they have no intention of funding the wall. And it's now time to get on with it.
Well, Steve, as we've talked about many times, Steve Bannon is the unholy alliance now between Democrats that want open borders so they can realign the vote makeup and the census in the United States, and Republican donors on Wall Street, Goldman Sachs, that want cheap labor. And so that's why we simply can't get anything done. And they feign border security. They don't want it because it benefits both sides. One wants to drive down wages. The other wants to get cheap votes and basically realign the whole system. I mean, you saw the other day that I think it was a judge in Manhattan that overturned Wilbur Ross, as the Commerce Secretary's, putting on the census a question, are you a U.S. citizen? I mean, that would seem to me to be a pretty simple thing to answer, yes or no. And if not, you really shouldn't be counted. That judge struck that down. And the benefits to the Democrats are the illegals come to areas that tend to be Democratic. So when the census is done, they're going to get more seats in the House, which is going to ensure their majority going forward. So basically, this is a raw grab for power, is it not?
Well, listen, the forces you say are aligned, and people should remember, you know, the Chamber of Commerce, the Republican establishment are just as big a force this year as the Democratic left.
Right.
This is nothing has done. Nothing has more has hurt the African American and Hispanic working class in this country than open, unmitigated, low skilled illegal alien labor.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And the logic for the business owners and for the Wall Street is that look, you get higher margins with lower wages. And the way you get lower wages, you have a bigger labor pool.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they've been one of the ones that have really been in back of the most forces. This is why the Republican establishment never really worked with Trump. You see the half-hearted attempt. You know, Mitch McConnell is missing in action in this debate because he really, you know, they have no interest in building a wall. They have no interest in southern border security. They want to give happy talk on this phrase called enhanced border security, which means the situation we're in today. And we've talked about this ad nauseum for the last 10 or 15 years. And I think President Trump is going to come to the point to say, look, I have for the last month and a half, I've stayed in the White House. I've been here to negotiate. Mm-hmm. I'm open to do a deal. Now they're not even meeting. I don't think Schumer said the other day he hasn't talked to the president in 5 or 6 days. There's no engagement on this at all. And I think the president has reached out to people. He said, look, we can cut any type of deal. I can be very aggressive. You see that there's no interest from the Democrats who want the votes and, quite frankly, the Republican establishment who wants the cheap labor. And so this thing can only be brought to a head, I think, by the president. And that's why I think he's going to have to at some point in time say, hey, I've tried the appropriations process for 2 years. I made this a priority. We tried to work through this. I never got really a penny for it. I got a couple of $1 billion to do some prototypes and to do some rework on the existing fencing and border wall that had already been put up. But yeah, there's no intention. And this is the thing people should remember. It's a $4.3 trillion appropriations bill that we put forward that has a $1 trillion deficit in it. $4.3 trillion has all the, you know, Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid plus the, you know, the $1.3 to $1.5 trillion of discretionary spending. And so the cost of the wall is not the issue. The wall is an interest payment for a mourning on the federal debt.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not about the cost of when people see the thing of 1.6 to 5 billion, that's all irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
This is because it's now become symbolic. It's now become totemic about the Trump movement. The Democrats feel they've got the president cornered. If he doesn't get a wall, he's not going to get reelected. And of course, you heard Ann Coulter last night on Vice. If you haven't seen it, it's up all over at Breitbart and Mediaite and other sites where she said the president's basically dead in 2020 unless he builds the wall. So both sides are dug in. The president's tried the appropriations process. I think it's now time to try something different.
Steve, I'm way over my time, but I just got one final question very quickly. AG nominee William Barr, what do you think?
I didn't look. Barr is an extremely seasoned guy. He comes from the Bush apparatus. He's a terrific lawyer. People speak very highly of him. I wasn't enthusiastic. Number one, he sat on the board of Time Warner, and he sat on the board of Time Warner that oversees CNN.
Mm-hmm.
He also sat on the board of Time Warner, was one of the guys that pushed the Time Warner AT&T merger, which we adamantly fought in the Trump administration. It's a foundation of elite media power against the people. So I thought his hearing yesterday was terrific. I thought he had some great responses. He's not exactly a guy that would come to mind when you think of the MAGA agenda, but the president wants him as attorney general. It's a very troubled time. The attorney general is going to be in the middle of all of it, so we'll have to see what happens.
Steve Bannon, we're out of time. Can Trump get reelected 2020?
President Trump can definitely get reelected in 2020. I was just up in Pennsylvania yesterday talking to people there. He can get reelected if he's got to get the wall built, and if he sticks to the program that he won on and that is closest to his heart and to his natural instincts. President Trump can grind through 2019, and people should understand, I think this is going to be the nastiest year in American politics since 1856. I think we're in for a historic year of just pure vitriol, and I think the president can grind through this. He's a very tough individual. He's a winner. I think he can grind through this. If he grinds through 2019 and he implements the policies, the America First policies, the MAGA agenda, I think he definitely can win in 2020. But I got to tell you, it is going to be a grind from now to election night of 2020. Every day is going to be a war. So it's going to be tough. But if you got to back somebody, it's tough. Donald Trump's the guy.
All right. Steve Bannon, former chairman, Trump campaign, won the general election. former senior advisor to President Trump and his administration, now the chairman of Citizens for the American Republic. That is a C4 company. You can see his film. Go to TrumpAtWar.com. Steve Bannon, thanks for being with us, Steve. I really appreciate the time.
Talk radio, AM 600, 101.1 FM, WBOB.
With SRN News, I'm Gordon Griffin. The partial government shutdown has entered its second month with a proposal from President Donald Trump. The president lashed out Sunday against House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other Democrats for dismissing his proposal to temporarily extend protections for young immigrants brought to the country illegally as children and those fleeing disaster zones. In exchange, the president still wants $5.7 billion for the border wall. A major winter storm brought some of the coldest temperatures of the season and blanketed a wide swath of the country in snow as it wreaked havoc on air travel and caused dangerously icy conditions throughout New England Sunday. National Weather Service issued winter storm warnings or advisories for part or all of at least 15 states, stretching from southeast Missouri to the northern tip of Maine. More details at srnnews.com.
Pat Boone here again, and I assure you, I have never before endorsed a pain relief product. Not until now. Not until Relief Factor came along as a 100% drug-free solution for people struggling with ordinary pain. Quite simply, Relief Factor was designed by doctors to help relieve those occasional aches and pains due to aging, exercise, and everyday living. Let me ask you, are aches and pains keeping you from sleeping through the night? Or keeping you from taking those nice long walks or playing golf or tennis? You can't really call it living if you can't get around comfortably. The 3-week quick start from Relief Factor may be all you need to lower or even eliminate these pains. A whole lot of people have already gone to ReliefFactor.com, and here's something you need to know. The majority of people who order the 3-week quick start, now only $19.95, go on to order more. Let's see if we can get you out of pain too. Go to ReliefFactor.com.
Transmission problems? Call Action Transmission Specialists on Merrill Road, where you get the work done right the first time by the experts. I'm Robin Sidbury, the owner. Our techs can service all makes and models, and we provide a nationwide warranty, so you have the peace of mind knowing we solve your transmission troubles fairly and honestly and guaranteed nationwide. Call us at Action Transmission Specialist on Merrill Road, where quality counts. Get traction. Call Action at 744-0755.
Z, the founder of the original Tunis restaurant, and Robert Rukab, the owner of St. John Seafood Restaurant, have teamed up. The result is a new national chain called Tip Top Chicken and Shrimp. Tip Top Chicken and Shrimp features the time-tested recipes of seafood and chicken and more. Two Tip Top Chicken and Shrimp locations are now open in Jacksonville, 847 Dunn Avenue, just west of I-95, and now also at 101 Monument Road, just off Atlantic Boulevard. Tip Top Chicken and Shrimp, the best you've ever tasted. 847 Dunn Avenue and 101 Monument Road.
Homeowners, now is the season to be thinking about your roof, because all it takes is one storm to turn a small roof problem into a major leak. If it's time for a new roof, get your roofing installed the right way with Sears. Call Sears for a free in-home consultation. Sears licensed, fully insured contractors can get your roofing job done right. You'll get reliable service and installation. And Sears has a variety of shingles and styles that are built for long-lasting performance. So if you need a new roof, don't wait till the next storm. Call Sears Roofing for a free in-home consultation. Call 1-888-990-2233. That's 1-888-990-2233. Not available in all areas. Installation provided by Sears Authorized Licensed Contractors. License information available upon request. That's Sears Roofing. Call right now. 1-888-990-2233. 1-888-990-2233. Sears.
Joining us now, Corey Lewandowski. Corey, the engineer of the big Trump primary nomination victory from New Hampshire. Corey, also the author of two best-selling books along with Dave Bossi, Let Trump Be Trump and Trump's Enemies. And now, Corey has a new podcast. Yes, I know you love podcasts, right? Yeah, I know you love them. Podcasts are not easy to do. I don't have enough time to do one, but I'm living my podcast vicariously through Corey and Dave Bossi. Guess what it's called? deep in the swamp. That's because they're deep in the swamp. The Corey Lewandowski, Dave Bossy podcast comes out every Wednesday. It's called Deep in the Swamp, and you can find it. Just go to roughrider.media, not .com, roughrider.media. It's also on Apple, iTunes, and all that. Just look for Deep in the Swamp and the Corey Dave podcast, which just came out, their first issue, just out. And he's joining us now. Corey Lewandowski, great to have you, sir.
John, I'm back in the swamp, so it's a snowy swamp today, but I'm back.
I know. I stayed in Southeast Virginia to stay out of it. I know you texted me yesterday and you said, are you in our swamp studio? Well, I'm like, no, I'm staying in Southeast Virginia where we have no snow. Corey, I want to start with a somber note. Our good friend Bruce Benton had a stroke on Friday. One of your and I best friends. He's been there for us with the Trump campaign in New Hampshire for a long time. He's also a dear friend of ours. He's in ICU, I believe. Just give a quick update on him, Corey.
Yeah, you know, it's terrible. Bruce is a young guy. He's only in his early 50s. He had a stroke late last week. They've had him in a medically induced coma. He's at Portsmouth Regional Hospital, where he was helicoptered up there. And I went to visit with him over the weekend, and really right now they're hoping that the swelling in his brain goes down. He's got a great family, and our thoughts and prayers are with him and his entire family right now.
If everybody out there can say a prayer for Bruce Benton, our friend in New Hampshire, great guy. He's been there with the Trump campaign with Corey from the very beginning. He did a lot of work for us during the campaign in New Hampshire, and just an all-around great guy, and also ran the Negron for Congress campaign. So it's just a sad situation, especially a man of that age to be in that sort of shape. So keep him in your prayers. Corey, your new podcast, Deep in the Swamp, what inspired this?
You know, John, it's an opportunity to go out and tell the real story, what's really going on, because you and I have seen it too often. We've seen the fake news stories. We've seen the fake news on the legacy media outlets. And so Dave Bossy and I decided that it was important for us, particularly leading into the re-election campaign, to have a forum to go out and tell people exactly what's going on from deep in the swamp. And we call it deep in the swamp because we're going to tell you what's really going on in Washington. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, you're a swamp creature, number one. I live in New Hampshire. But number two, you know, Dave and I both have access to people. Absolutely, you know what's going on in Washington. We talk to these people every day. We're at the White House on a regular basis, and we want our listeners to hear what's really taking place, to bypass the fake news and to get the truth. And that's what this is really all about.
Well, listen, I heard the first one. I was there when you did the first one. I thought the content was outstanding. And now it's going to be every Wednesday? A new one comes
up every Wednesday. And, you know, John, look, it's a work in progress. You know, you've been doing this. You're a pro. You've been on the radio for 8 years. You know, our first podcast just went up. I hope, you know, in 8 years from now, if I'm lucky enough to still be involved somehow, that I'm as good as you are. But we're going to have a lot of special guests. Look, I think we're going to have some governors on, some former governors, some members of the cabinet, some previous members of the cabinet. I have the privilege, as you know, of working with the vice president's political action committee. So I'd like to get him on. And maybe if it all works out well, maybe we'll have the privilege of getting the boss on, the president of the United States, and let him go directly to the American people. But it's just so important. When I pick up the newspapers or I hear the stories on the TV, I know what the truth is because I've lived it. And the latest ridiculousness that the FBI potentially opened up an investigation into the president after the firing of Jim Comey is so salacious, so outrageous, that I think our podcast on this Wednesday is going to be about that. And the guys like Peter Strzok and Lisa Page and Andy McCabe and all the things that are in our Trump enemies book, we're going to spend some time talking about it this week.
Corey, it's really unbelievable, the story that broke Friday by the New York Times. I was really flabbergasted by it. I never thought I'd see the Times, as bad as it is, as fake. I mean, it is fake news, basically. Even their former editor, Abramson, said that in her book, Merchants of Truth. She said headlines are opinion. They're done to get clicks, clickbait. That she said news analysis masquerades as its opinion masquerading as news. So, you know, she already debunked her own company saying it was fake news. But the story on Friday was unbelievable. I mean, I had to read that two times because the first time I said to myself, okay, there's something here I had to miss. So I went back, read the thing again, line by line. It's like there was absolutely no evidence there was no even indication of any evidence. It's just basically a bunch of overzealous FBI federal agents that hate Trump that basically concocted this in order to find a way to hurt him based on nothing. I mean, it's not like they had evidence or anything. It's just like, okay, he fired Comey, therefore he's an agent of a foreign country. I mean, what an absurd thing to write in the New York Times. I would have thought I would find that in The Onion.
Well, yeah, but where was the attorney general when all this was happening? The FBI says they're going to open an investigation. Where's the attorney general? He's lost in space.
Well, you know, when I was at the press briefing at the White House a week ago Monday, the president really blasted Jeff Sessions, and that was an on-the-record meeting with his top surrogates, Corey in the Nation, and he really skewered Jeff Sessions. He said he was the worst hire he had ever made in his life. He skewered him and said that anytime something tough came up that he just hid in his office and he couldn't wait to get rid of him. So I don't know where the attorney general was in all of this. But, you know, the other thing that we have never that has never come out is why the FISA thing was allowed to go through. How come that has not been released, Corey? I mean, why has the president just released that phony FISA application for all the world to see? Why has he held back on that?
He needs to do this. Look, John, it's not just the FISA application, the renewals that were signed by Rod Rosenstein. It's the 302s, which are the FBI notes, which were by Bruce Orr, the number four person at the Justice Department, whose wife Nellie Orr was paid for and working for Fusion GPS, the creator of the false dossier. Mm-hmm. When is this information going to become public? Because what they're afraid of, what those members of the Justice Department are afraid of, is that they know that they were lying when that FISA application was filled out, which, by the way, is a crime. They know that they did this to go after someone based on their politics. And now this story that they went after Donald Trump, that they potentially opened an investigation because of his potential support of Russia, which we know is not true, if that's the criteria, are we going after Hillary Clinton for Uranium One? Are we going after Barack Obama for the reset? This is partisan politics at its worst. It will look back. We will look back on this episode at the FBI, and it will hurt their reputation for the next 50 years. 12 senior members of the FBI, from the director to the general counsel to the deputy director to the person in charge of counterintelligence, have all either been fired or have left for other reasons, and there is more coming. And I said it last night on Lou Dobbs, and I'll say it again. These people should have been taken out in handcuffs. Mm-hmm. They should have been perp walked. And these people need to be accountable because Andy McCabe, who is the acting director who opened this investigation, on the day he became the acting director, lied to his own FBI under oath on three separate occasions. And there was nothing, nothing, nothing that's been done about it.
Well, because they're Democrats. I mean, if there's no other answer for this, because we have two sets of justice, one for Republicans and Trump and the other for anybody else who's opposed to him, and they don't meet in the middle. It's like when you read this New York Times piece alleging that they thought that President Trump could have been an agent. I mean, get this, an agent of the Russian government because of his foreign policy, which, by the way, has been very anti-Russia, especially as it relates to energy, Syria, and everything else. But you look at Obama, that's like saying, okay, Obama gave, you know, $2.2 billion cash on pallets, flew it in cargo planes to Iran and signed a horrific deal. Does that make Obama an agent of the Iranian government? Just his foreign policy view. This thing is absurd beyond belief. And the fact is, every single legacy media has picked it up as if it's a real story. That's what's even more disturbing. You would have thought that some of the legacy media would have at least had the courage to say, really, this is kind of a ridiculous expose, and the Times should be ashamed of themselves. No, every one of the legacy liberal left-wing anti-Trump media picked it up as if it was a serious expose.
But ask yourself why, John. Why did they pick it up on Friday? Because the real story, which they didn't want to report on, was dozens of members of Congress, hundreds of staffers down on the boondoggle in Puerto Rico, right, with Bob Menendez with his shirt off talking to the girl behind the, you know, the umbrella in the bikini. That's what the real story is during a government shutdown. Because let me tell you, John, if that were the Republicans,
oh my God,
would be the only news story. Mm-hmm. So instead, they come up with this false narrative, and I watched all the clips on it. a bombshell report has now hit. Breaking news. We must tell you. You know, whatever legacy channel you turned into, MSNBC, NBC, CBS, ABC, CNN, it was the only story. There was not a mention, hardly, of the Democrats down in Puerto Rico on a boondoggle, on a chartered private 737 so they could be on vacation while the government is closed and have the ability to bypass TSA because they had a special chartered plane. That's what the real story is, and nobody wants to admit it. And if you know the facts, Nancy Pelosi was supposed to be on that trip, but I think she was sunburned from her trip to Hawaii, so she took a pass on the Puerto Rico trip.
I mean, 30 of them went out, 109 lobbyists flew on a charter jet right in the middle of government shutdown while they're all whining and squealing about government government employees not getting paid. They can't put food on the table. They can't pay rent. They can't buy medicine. And they're frolicking in Puerto Rico with 109 lobbyists, which was basically 3.3 lobbyists for every congressman there, coupled with the fact they brought their families, their staff. I mean, the whole thing is just, it's gross, but you're right, gets knocked off the front pages. We're with Corey Lewandowski. Corey Lewandowski and Dave Bossy, the author of two best-selling New York Times books, Let Trump Be Trump. That's about the campaign, Trump's enemies, about his administration. Buy them both. You can get those on our website. Just go to johnfredericks.com. Click the link on the ad tier for their books. It's right there. Plus, he's now the author of a weekly Wednesday podcast, Deep in the Swamp, which you can get by going to their website, roughrider.media. How easy is that? Roughrider.media. Corey, let's get to the shutdown. Everybody told me 2 weeks ago the president was going to cave and that they'd find some way out. I don't think that's going to happen, Corey, not based on what I've seen.
Well, you know, John, I just came through the airport. I had to fly out of Boston this morning. I landed down at Reagan National. And I got off the airplane, and a guy stopped me, and he said, "Hey, you Corey Lewandowski?" I said, "Yes, I am." He said, "Hey, do me a favor." I said, "What's that?" He said, "Tell the president to keep fighting. We voted for him to fight for us, and we can tough this one out." And I'll tell you what, I believe that. And look, Jennifer Jacobs, the Bloomberg reporter, had a tweet out today that said she was down in maybe Charleston or Charlotte, and she ran into a CBP official as she was coming through airport security. And he asked her, he said, "Oh, you're from Washington, D.C. What do you do?" And she said, "I'm a reporter." And he said, "We're with the president. We're here. We're not getting paid. We have our savings, but we'll never get our lives back, basically. So make sure the president keeps fighting for us." And, John, I know it's tough. Believe me, I grew up poor. I know what it's like to not have any money, and I feel for the families who aren't getting their paychecks. But if we don't fight this fight right now, today, our children and our grandchildren will pay the price for it in perpetuity, because it will take one illegal immigrant coming across a border that we don't have protected and kill one of our children that we will be here saying, "Why didn't we do everything we could?" And God forbid it ever happens. But unfortunately, we know it happens all too often. And we have to stand firm with the president to get the wall or the barrier or the partition or whatever it is you want to call it built so that we can have a safe and secure country just like every other country on the planet that did it. Look, I just saw last week another country just finished a 714-kilometer long wall on the border of Syria to keep Syria out of their country.
Turkey.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, look, if it works over there, why doesn't it work here? Of course it does. And that's what our podcast, Deep in the Swamp, is about. I think this week it's about the wall. It's about making sure we're protecting Americans because, you know, John, like you, I have met so many angel mothers that I've traveled around the country and angel fathers and people who've lost their loved ones because of illegal immigrants. And I don't understand how we even allow this, how this conversation can even be going on anymore. We have to do everything. And the only solution that I see is building that barrier on the southern border. And we have to make sure the president holds firm. And if he doesn't get the money and he has done everything he can, then I will go on and encourage the president once again to declare a national emergency because we are at an emergency in our country and we have to do everything we can to stop it.
I think he's got to do it. And look, the president has said he'd rather find a legislative solution, and I think he's trying to do that. And by the way, he's not going to Mar-a-Lago and he's not going to Puerto Rico. He and his staff and the vice president's team, they're staying in the White House. They're willing to negotiate. The Democrats are not going to do that. There's no end in sight. But I agree with you, Corey. The president, this is just one of the things he cannot cave on. This is what he promised, and this is what he has to do. But if they can't resolve it legislatively, I agree with you 110%. He has to declare a national emergency, get the military down there, break ground, get it stopped. Some judge in San Francisco will stop it, and then it'll go all the way up to the top, and we'll see what plays out. I don't think he's got any other choice, and I think if it gets up there, he's going to get the authority, because you can't tell the executive branch what moves they can make in a national emergency. Otherwise, you'll have the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco running our military, right? I mean, it's crazy.
John, 52 times since 1974, presidents have declared national emergencies. Bill Clinton declared 17 of them in 8 years, of which six of them are still in effect today. So this is not something new. This started with Jimmy Carter following the Iran hostage crisis or right around that time. And look, it is something that should be used very rarely. But what this president has attempted to do is he is now attempting for the fourth week to negotiate with the Democrats. And what they've said is, hey, you open the government for 30 days and we'll negotiate again on day 29. That's not how it works. We need a solution. We need an equitable solution. And if they're not willing to come to the table, then this president has the legal authority to declare that emergency, and the American people will stand with him.
I think that is exactly what he has to do. The people stand with him. He's got to do the right thing, and he's got to get this done. And you look at the border crisis and the number of migrants coming in. Look, you said the other day, Corey, there's another, 15,000-strong caravan developing in Honduras, basically after Congress appropriated $10 billion for them, right, on paper. They got another caravan coming. I mean, there's no end in sight of these. And as I said over and over, this is the unholy alliance. Democrats that feign border security, they want open borders, they want cheap votes, and your Wall Street Republican friends at Goldman Sachs like Gary Cohn that want cheap labor. That's why you get the basic open border situation that we've had. Corey Lewandowski's podcast coming out again Wednesday.
John,
Corey,
one last idea, and it may be a crazy one. Look, if we can't get this wall built on our side, let's give the money in foreign aid to Mexico and make them build on their side. I'm sure the Democrats would be in favor of that.
Hey, that's a great idea. We already gave them $10 billion. Why not give them $15 billion and say, hey, here's $5 billion. Get Mexican jobs. In fact, you can hire the migrants that have come up. You've already offered them one-year work visas, and they can build the wall. Perfect.
That's exactly right. Hey, John, like, we got to think outside the box, so to speak. So if we got to give them $15 billion, we've already given them $10 billion. They'll build the wall on their side. They'll keep them in. We'll keep them out. Same thing for us.
I love the idea. Corey Lewandowski podcast coming up Wednesday. Check it out, Deep in the Swamp, roughrider.media. Joining us now, America's Sheriff, Sheriff David Clark. Hey, Sheriff, great to have you.
It's a pleasure to be on with you, and hello once again to your listeners.
Well, the government shut down now going on a month, and no end in sight. But I want to get your comment here. I'm going to play a clip from Senator Lindsey Graham of North Carolina. This is pretty interesting. He says that some Senate Republicans and Democrats are working together to try to end the partial shutdown. And he says, look, let's open the government for 3 weeks, see if we can get a deal done. If we can't, then just go ahead and invoke the national emergency, which Graham also says he really doesn't want to do. Let's get your comment on that.
Some House guys came over last night. There's a group within a group feeling like they can do something. But I don't see Nancy Pelosi's teams breaking on her. I don't see Republicans breaking on Mitch McConnell, but what I do see is R's and D's in the Senate trying to produce a product working with the president that may get us out of this mess. There's no other way to get a bill signed without the president's signature. There's no way to get a deal without the president talking to Democrats and Republicans. Nobody's going to talk seriously with each other as long as the government shut down, I think. But if you had a small opportunity, a couple of weeks, that's the best chance for a breakthrough. I can't guarantee you an outcome if you give us 3 weeks, but I pretty well can guarantee you we're going nowhere quick doing what we're doing.
Sheriff Clark, so Lindsey Graham, here's what he said. Look, we're trying to get a deal behind the curtain. I don't think they're going to get one, but he says, let's just open the government for 3 weeks, try to get it hashed out. If we can't, then just declare a national emergency, get the military down there, get shovels, break ground. The Ninth Circuit will immediately issue an injunction to stop it and then take it to the Supreme Court and go from there. What are your thoughts on that plan?
I don't like it. You know, I respect Lindsey Graham. Good for him for trying. Some people have to work at these things behind the scenes. But until and unless this group of Democrats can get it by Nancy Pelosi, it's not going to happen in the Senate. If they can't get it by Chuck Schumer, and I don't believe he's given them any kind of authority to hash out a deal. I don't know what Lindsey Graham meant when he said, let's open it up, the government up for 3 weeks and continue the discussions. He said, under this partial shutdown, we're going nowhere fast. Well, they've gone nowhere fast on this issue for the last three decades, John, and you know this, mm-hmm. for three decades. And you know what? They squandered an opportunity. They, meaning the GOP in Congress, squandered an opportunity for two solid years to get this done. They passed several omnibus bills, several continuing resolutions, no wall funding. So, you know, the president, I do not believe, is going to fall for this trick. Well, let's open up the government and then we can continue discussion, because that's a trick. That's mm-hmm. all it is. It's a political trick. The Democrats get what they want. They get the government open, and then they don't have to hear about President Trump having any leverage for wall funding. And they'll continue to debate this ad nauseum, and nothing will ever move. This is the only way, this is the only leverage, really, that the president has. I'm a little skeptical as to whether he'll declare a national emergency. I'm not predicting he won't. But the thing is, if he does, it's going, as you indicated, it's going to be immediately challenged. An injunction is going to be issued. So the government will be open. The president loses his leverage. He won't get wall funding or border security funding, which the wall is just a part of. So I think that the president is in a good position right now. This polls well for him, and I'm talking in terms of border security and fixing our immigration system and ending illegal immigration. And he just has to stay the course on this and starve him out. You know, eventually something will happen, but in the end, I think the pressure will play more on the Democrats to sit down and seriously. You heard Nancy Pelosi the other day. I won't give him more than a dollar for border funding. What kind of negotiating tactic is that? That's basically a slap in the face. It's basically a no, put in a sarcastic way.
Sheriff Clark, you are so right. If Pelosi had simply said, well, we'll try to get something worked out that makes sense for the American people, even if she's not going to negotiate, but when you say, you know what, I'm not giving you a dollar, so you can do whatever you want, then there is no negotiation, and then the whole thing becomes a facade, and that's really what they're doing right now, and it's shameful, and we're calling it the Trump shutdown. I don't think it matters what you call it. It is what it is, but the president looking for some ability to negotiate. I mean, I've heard people inside the White House tell me if they went to the president today and said, I'll split the difference and give you 2-8, he'd take it. Right? Or he would take something close to that. He certainly entertained the conversation. And one of our congressmen in Virginia, Morgan Griffith, I nailed it a week ago. He said the Democrats are not going to go to Trump with a deal. He said because they're afraid he'll say yes. And that's really what their problem is. What do you think of that?
Yeah, because this is strictly political for Pelosi and Schumer. Look, this isn't about $5.7 billion.
Right.
You and your listeners know that, John.
Right.
This is about denying President Trump a political win. At least that's how they see it, where the president, as I've always said, sticks to policy. This is about border security. It's about protecting the sovereignty of the United States, and he stays on that message. So, you know, for $5.7 billion out of a $4 trillion a bill, you know, it's not that much. I can't believe that the Democrats Pelosi and Schumer want to die on this hill.